from the 1960s. She said they found more than 100 congressional hearings in which CO2 and human-caused climate change were discussed.
And what we were able to show was that the members of Congress who wrote and passed the Clean Air Act were well aware of carbon dioxide, and they understood that it was a pollutant.
She says that's why the words weather and climate are included in the text of the law.
And so if anyone tries to claim, oh, there's no way Congress could have intended this statute to apply to carbon dioxide, it's just wrong. And we've now shown that it's wrong.
And she says knowing what lawmakers intended back then is important when determining how the law should be applied now. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Today on Wings. It's used in several parts of the world, and it's older than Islam. The movement to stop it is just decades old. It's being called female circumcision, female genital cutting, or female genital mutilation, FGM for short. Our reporter in Kenya, Diana Wanyonyi, visits a Nairobi slum to hear from a woman who was cut and then married off when she was just a girl. Then we hear from an organizer against cutting, and finally, an international perspective.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Kibera slum in Kenya is located in Nairobi. Despite the challenges of inadequate water supply and poor housing, it is one of the biggest urban slum dwellings in Africa with a population of around 1 million. This slum also hosts more than 40 tribes. Some of the girls here experience violation of their rights by being forced or coerced by family members or friends to undergo the cut. Nabuki is one of the girls who underwent the cut at the age of 10 years back in her rural home in Kuria. Do you know the meaning of Nabuki? It is a name meaning a person who does not have a father. I was born out of wedlock. I don't know who my father is. We were 7 girls ready to do female genital mutilation. One of the girls died during the process because of overbleeding. We stayed in that hut where the practice was done. Then we saw a group of men sitting outside the small hut. One small boy came running to me and said that I was being married off. I didn't believe it because I was 10 years old. When I interrogated him further, he said that mother said that we should not tell you. I was called by one of the elderly women who told me to go fetch water in a nearby stream. I accepted. When I came back home with water in a pot, the same men stood up and surrounded me. I asked them what they want. One of them said they are asking me to show them the road to the neighboring village. They were smartly dressed and some of the faces looked familiar. I kept quiet. One of the men forcefully grabbed my hands. My elder brother, who plays the role of father in our family, politely told him to be gentle with me. My brother told my mother that these men are living with me. She said, "She is your sister and I have nothing to say. Do what pleases you, because when I say my mind, you will beat me." My uncle, who was trying to shield me from them, was even threatened to be killed. They said, "This is not your child." My brother said, "Just go because we don't want to kill you." FGM is a violation of girls' and women's human rights. Siyama Ismail is a female human rights activist based in Kibera. She explains her work and how she is helping to fight FGM.
My name is Siyama Ismail. I am the female Kenya Nubian cultural ambassador. I live in Kibera. I was born in Kibera, raised in Kibera, educated elsewhere, but still came back to Kibera. My roots are here. I volunteer for many organizations within the community. Mm-hmm. But currently we have a community-based organization that is the Muslim Center for Peace and Reconciliation. It's a CBO where we do interfaith programs, including conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. There's just quite a lot that I do in the community. Mm-hmm. And most of all, I am a human rights activist or a human rights defender. So I believe in defending people's rights because I've been violated so many times. You know, you know your rights, but then you still feel that your rights are being violated. And it's not so many people who know about their rights. So you find that they have to, like, at times bribe their way into services because they don't know their rights. But at the end of the day, I'm proud of what I do in the community. And I also spearhead women campaigns in Kibra and Nairobi, at times even nationally. I do that through media. I also do that locally, at the grassroots level, and of course, which I love doing most, because you find that in the village or in the Kijiji, many women are being violated. Girls are being violated, including men. And since they don't know their rights, they would never stand up to raise their voices. Also, in the community, I help raise sanitary towels, and we distribute them among the girls who don't have. There's an initiative that we have. I call it Pad a Girl or Adapt a Girl. I don't collect the pads, but I identify friends and I identify girls, and they adopt these girls and provide them with sanitary towels for as long as they can, so that at the end of the day, the girls become independent and not dependent. So once they feel that they're old enough or mature enough to buy their own, they also adopt other girls. So, because in Kibra, for some time, people have been saying that girls, it has even been in the media, that girls have been selling themselves in order to buy the pads. So that is one thing that we want the world to know, that if you adopt a girl, they cannot go do any kind of illegal businesses just to protect their dignity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then women's rights. I'm in 1990, way before 1995, I was employed somewhere. And then after that, I joined the Kenya Anti-Rape Organization, which was an NGO at that time, because it was actually heading campaigns for violence against women at that time. And then COVAW, that is Coalition on Violence Against Women, was founded because big NGOs came together and they formed Coalition on Violence Against Women, which has now become an NGO on its own. I was just, you know, like joining the civil society world, knowing that I'll be going to defend human rights, women's rights. But when once or twice I was violated, not seriously, but I felt that my rights were violated, then I decided now this is the path that I'm going to take. I have to go on defending women's rights. The first time my rights were violated, I was actually in a public vehicle. Those days when you got into a bus and the bus would be packed like... And I said, there was this guy who was standing near me, and the guy somehow was trying to... You know, I felt uncomfortable the way he was pushing against me. So I turned and looked at him. He smiled. The second time I turned and looked at him, he smiled again. So every time I pushed away from him, he'd come close. Now the third time I said no. Somebody has to hear my voice. Then I had to ask him quite loudly, what is it that you want from me? Why are you rubbing your body against me? And he looked at me and said, like, you're a mad woman. I said, no, I'm not mad, because I'm moving and you're still moving. And when I look at you, you smile. So now I'm raising my voice. What you're doing is not good. Mm-hmm. I am feeling uncomfortable. Can you please push aside or just go somewhere else? In that same bus, it was a public service vehicle. The bus... There were a few people who heard me. Actually, many people heard me. But at that time, people would shy off. You know, when you raise your voice to talk about something that seems a little bit odd in the community. So, but there were a few people, including 5 men that I remember. You know, one even shouted at that guy and told him that you don't have manners. She's saying that she's feeling uncomfortable and you're still rubbing your body against hers. What do you want? He was almost being beaten. So what he had to do, he jumped out of the bus. Then I said, okay. From that day on, there was no turning back for me, because it was like, my voice can save me from so many things. My voice can be somebody else's voice. Mm-hmm. So from today onwards, I'm going to use my voice to raise issues on human rights violations. And that was the beginning, and it has never been the end for me. And I started raising issues about human rights, women, especially women rights violation, the girl child, starting with my community, the Nubian community. We had FGM was very, very, very much practiced in my Nubian community. Mm-hmm. In fact, it stopped in the 80s, towards the mid 80s, because former retired President Daniel Arap Moi had said that anybody who takes the girl child to be circumcised will be prosecuted. And you know, Kibra, he lived in Cabernet Gardens. Yes. Of course, being the Nubian community and you live in Kibra, everybody knew that the first community that will be targeted was my community. And that was when the practice stopped. Although like now, it is still being done, but in secrecy. And in what they call hygiene way, because I understand it's nurses who do it. They take their girls to the clinics. It's not that FGM, that like they call it, but it's something that I've said, you know, I even know where the clinic is, but I cannot, you know, like take any actions against them, mm-hmm. because I don't have proof. Mm-hmm. You know, when a girl is taken there, probably it's just for a little dressing or whatever it is they do there. But they say, for those that I've talked to, they say it's not very severe. It just appears on the clitoris and then that is it. But for me, whatever it is, it is violation of that girl's right, mm-hmm. because she didn't want it. Mm-hmm. And she was being forced into it because culture says so. Mm-hmm. And then you see that even men themselves, they say, now I cannot marry a girl who's not circumcised, forcing the girls to go, mm-hmm. or even asking the girls to ask their parents to do it, to take them. Mm-hmm. So aside from now, I raised my voice there, because actually when we were little, we also underwent that. And then there was a time I sat my mom down and asked her, and my mom said, no, you know, I didn't want to myself. I really did not want to. But your grandmother said that this is what you have to undergo this. It's the passage of right. And I had, my hands were tied then. But if my mom was very, very, very apologetic. And seeing her and the fact that she did not want to, that even gave me much strength, you know, to fight against FGM in my community. So now it is something like almost 5% being done. Mm-hmm. The 95% is good results, positive results, because anytime, in fact, I even go to homesteads and tell girls, you know, like when they tell you that they're going to take you to the clinics for this and this, tell them you'll tell Auntie Siama. And when they, just the mention of my name, it sends shivers in parent homes.
On Wings, you're listening to Diana Wanyonyi's interview with Siama Ismail, a human rights activist working against female genital mutilation in the community where she was born, the Kibera slum in Nairobi, Kenya. Female genital mutilation refers to all procedures involving partial or total removal of the female external genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. Although FGM has declined in Kenya, the practice is still done secretly in some communities, and in some communities it has only changed its form.
How many girls have you rescued so far? And do you have a rescue center?
We used to have a rescue center, but now we have a... Okay, we liaise with other rescue centers, because in a place like Kibra you cannot have a shelter, mm-hmm. for girls who've undergone FGM. So most of the times I'll house them in my place, in my home, until I sit down with the parents and I talk to them. And it's not just girls from the Nubian community. We have other communities. The Meru community, we have the Teso community, the Kisi community. Kibra is cosmopolitan. We have like almost all the Kenyan tribes living in Kibra. Then you find that I didn't know that it was being done in Kibra until I got some leakages, you know, because I interacted with like almost everybody in the community. So they tell me, in our community we do. You know, this month, girls will be undergoing this passage. We won't take them up country. We'll do it around here. This is the place we'll do it. So There was a time I intercepted three Kamba girls. Mm-hmm. They were going to do it. I didn't even know the Kamba community did it. But somehow I had to dig deeper and I was told, yes, they did it. The Meru, and there was one Meru girl who was also going to undergo it. We went, we raided the home where the girls were kept. We rescued the girls from that. And also the teachers in school. We always, by the way, you even find that teachers are the ones who bring you reports. They tell you that these girls have undergone this passage. Yes, it was done, but you have to talk to them so that they go and talk to the other girls because they've been told, they've been forced to do it. They did not want to. But if you tell them, you know, they'll go and tell the other girls. So somehow we managed to talk to women community elders. And they've sent the messages back. We told them that if they don't educate the community, we'll also go back to the Agishagi and educate the community. However, you find that some other communities still insist that she's not a woman. She's not woman enough until she's been circumcised. So they go willingly. You know, a person who goes willingly, you cannot stop that person from going. She's already like almost 18 years old. And I don't know why people believe that you have to get married early. At 20 years old, a girl will tell, a woman will tell you, a lady will tell you that, you know, I'm 20 years old, I haven't seen any man in my life, it's because they've not done this to me. So they willingly go. So that at the end of the day, she'll be married because she underwent it. What we've done so far is I also sit with the imams because in my community, we have Baraza la Walimu Kibra. It is an umbrella of a Muslim Center for Peace and Reconciliation. And we have all the ma'alims and the imams and the sheikhs in it. So what we do, we sit down. Mm-hmm. When we sit down, you know, like we always invite them for talks, to give talks. They have to give the religious side, the religious perspective. Is it, if it is a must in religion, for this to be done or not. So, you know, they use their religious
teachings,
you know, to educate the community that this is not a must to be done. Because, like, in Islam, female FGM, you know, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, he went to a certain part of Egypt and the girl child was being violated to that. You know, they were being cut until they bled to death. Then he told them, instead of doing all this to that, to this girl child, why don't you just cut a little bit piece of it if it is blood that you want to see. That is why they say that it is sooner that they cut the tip of the clitoris. That is how it came. So you see, in the Quran, it is not there. But in the teachings of the Prophet, he saw it and he wanted to stop that girl child from being violated because they'll die. You know, those days girls probably did not mean a lot. It's boys who meant a lot. So to stop it, he said instead of, he could not stop it completely and tell them, don't do it. But this is the alternative. If you must do it, do this. So the imams use that, the teachings to help out. And then we also have an interfaith group. The interfaith, we talk to the pastors and the Sunday school teachers because they have a way of talking to the parents. And
bishops.
And the bishops, yeah. And they know the communities that do that. So they also have a religious approach of it. How? This is harmful. It is a very, very harmful practice. They'll also use examples of women of status in the Bible, in the Quran, and, you know, give examples that if there were women who did this, there were women who did that. So you don't need to undergo a certain passage of rite of passage, so that you be called a woman in this world. That is how the approach is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what about male involvement? How do you reach men now?
Men, it's always easy to talk to them. Actually, there's one thing that I noticed in the community, it is women who are the enemies of the women. But men actually support women initiatives a lot. All you need to do is sit them down, talk to them, and hear from them as well. Because most of the times they have something inside. Maybe they have something that they want to say, but they are not given the platform. Why? Because they feel that this is not a man's, you know, it is a man's world, yes, but it would not be. Like some time ago, we were talking to some other two young boys, and they're telling us, like, imagine it is July and it is very, very cold, and then you go and shave your hair and walk, you know, that is the Nairobi weather, and you walk without a hat and you've shaved bald, you'll feel cold. You know, they give those kinds of examples, meaning that if you remove that woman's clitoris or you cut her, she'll feel cold. And then at times they'll even tell you, like, no, the woman's beauty is her, you know, and they'll explain it to you. So if you cut it, how beautiful will she be? Maybe it's the face and all that, you know, those kind of stuff. And then the youth, you also use the youth language. Like for me, I'm called Mama Vijana in Kibra. I also use them as a platform. Tell them this is what is happening. When you have your girlfriend and you're from this community, don't say that this girlfriend of yours, unless she undergoes this passage, will be a woman. You already saw her as she was. Love her and like her as the way she is, not the way you want your society to think. You can even lie for her, for them. If they ask you, nobody will go and open up your wife and ask, has she undergone this? No. You lie. You say yes. After you've married, you're there, you've had children, then you can even shout now and tell them she's not. What difference is there between her and those who've done it? She's had children. She's running a home. She's working. She can do anything any other woman can do, except that she's not circumcised. So what's the difference? You know, some of these practices are very harmful. For example, fistula. Where does it come about? I won't say, but I'd say like 50% of it comes from women who've undergone FGM. Because there's a way that they do it in some other communities that... it's very disgusting. Then childbirth, they become pregnant. When their due time comes, a woman cannot. She has prolonged labor. She pushes and pushes, but her passage is so small that the child cannot come out. So by the time that the doctors realize that, you know, when she undergoes a C-section or anything like that, her internal organs are already damaged. So that is where fistula comes. You know. How can you stop all that? Mm-hmm. We can only stop it if we do away with harmful cultural practices. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is the government doing enough to curb FGM here in Kenya?
There was a time that they said that funds would be released. But I don't know. You know, this is the government. There was even a committee that was formed to look into that. There was even, I cannot remember the name.
The Jabiki.
Yeah, the Jabiki. We were even there for 3 days, like... But after that, and that was back in 2012, I think, 2012, 2013. After that, nothing. No follow-up, no nothing. So we don't know where the funds went to. We don't know if the initiative is still even there. Because there was a time I saw on TV that she went, that area that she went to, FGM was being practiced, but is not being practiced. So how can you implement a project somewhere where it is not being practiced? There are areas like the Somali. You can go to Masailand. Still in the Gema community, within the Gema community, they do it. If you tell me about Kipsigis and Nini, I know they used to, but they don't do it. You go to Tesolan, you go to Kisi, they still do it. So the project was being implemented where FGM was not being practiced. So I don't know what happened.
So it was misplaced.
It was misplaced funds. Mm-hmm. I only wish that the money was used, brought back to us, so that we go and target other communities, the real communities. But that was quite a waste of resources.
That was Siyama Ismail, an activist against female genital mutilation in her home community, the Kibera slum in Nairobi, Kenya. She was interviewed in Kibera by Diana Wanyonyi.
So you have to usually choose with these harmful practices to either rebel and be radical and liberate yourself, or to submit to the idea that you are powerless, you're a social property, you have to ascribe to social norms that have control over our sexuality and our minds, and therefore our political being, our economic power, and our role in society.
Change Cultural Norms, Abandon Female Genital Mutilation. That was the title of a panel held June 4th, 2019 in Vancouver, Canada at the Women Deliver Conference. Here's the moderator.
My name is Aya Shebi. I am the envoy on youth for the African Union Commission. And since my appointment last November, I've been part of this African Union campaign to end FGM with the leadership of our champion, the president of Burkina Faso. And I've been collaborating with UNFPA and UNICEF to moderate intergenerational dialogues and raise awareness, especially about the urgency of action and the commitment, especially from our African member states. We know that FGM is everywhere in the world, but the highest risk is still in Africa. We have 200 million girls already undergone FGM. 125 million of them are in Africa. 68 million will undergo FGM if we do not act now, and 50 million of them are in Africa. So the highest risk remain in our continent. I come from a small village on the Tunisian-Algerian borders, where it's been practiced there a ritual called tasfih. So before the age of 9, before I got my period, me and my female cousins had to go through tasfih, which means a locker. So basically, we got into a room. An elder came, no explanation. She scratched my knee 7 times, made me eat seven dry grapes, and repeat a couple of times, "He is a rock. He is a thread. I am a rock." And this ritual is believed that your vagina is locked and your virginity is protected. And so before you get married, you have to unlock it and do the same. So that was, I think, for me, the start of a long trauma. The violation of our bodies might heal from the pain, but I think the violations of our mind and psychology and the trauma is very difficult to heal. I think what is needed today is more than women empowerment. It's about women liberation. It's about being our badass selves every day in our childhood and in our adulthood. There are many harmful practices that manifest in different communities, but I think FGM is really the ultimate act of violence or gender-based violence, and that's why we are discussing it today here. This practice is passed down from one generation to the other, and we need to be the last to endure this, and we need for every girl not to go through it. But also we need scale and speed. We have 16 African countries where this is practiced. We need to work on all those countries to move our commitments to action. What we're talking about today is at the heart of Agenda 2030, goal number 5. It's at the heart of Agenda 2063 of the African Union Aspiration 6. It's at the heart of gender-based violence discussion and why we are here today. And we need to work with young people. So really support and fund youth-led, young feminist-led initiatives on the front line at the grassroots level who are doing the job. And I think there are two important actors. One are political leaders. We have more than 100 men heads of states in this world. So FGM is political, and it needs political decisions. It's radical for women to support each other, but we need men. And we need religious actors, because all imams are men as well, and we need imams to be in our camp. This is not about just FGM. It's part of a broader conversation about violence against women and about how patriarchy uses violence as a weapon to keep women trapped in inequality. But you know, women are smarter. We use education as a weapon to get out of the trap. So we got this.
African Union Youth Envoy Aya Chebi speaking June 4th, 2019 at Women Deliver in Vancouver, Canada. On February 6, 2025, the UN Population Fund marked its 22nd annual International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. They estimated 230 million girls and women around the world had survived the practice, and 27 million more girls were currently at risk. To hear Wings programs again, visit the website wingsradio.org. Thank you to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Shana Hornstein, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hey, hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
Music and talk radio about all things